my gorgeous friend. How are you?
Beautiful lady. I'm amazing. How the fuck are you?
Girl, I'm great. Let me tell you. Two really exciting things fucking happened.
Tell me.
One, Trashy Diva, which is a New Orleans retro brand that I absolutely adore. And if you ever see me not at the bar, because what I wear at the bar is not what I wear in my normal life, but if you ever see me out and about looking cute, there's a 60% chance what I'm wearing is Trashy Diva. Well, the designer and several of the head queens of Trashy Diva not only came to New York, but paid me a visit at my bar. And it was iconic. It was everything. I was on cloud nine. I was like very low-key fangirling really hard. It was amazing.
Oh my God. I love that.
I'm obsessed.
I know. I feel like I've complimented outfits of yours several times. And every time I have, the answer is always, oh, it's Trashy Diva.
It's Trashy Diva and it has pockets.
Sold.
Like that's literally all of the time. Yes, exactly. Because Candace fucking nails it.
You were in the presence of Trashy Diva royalty. I love it.
10,000%. It was incredible. It was so exciting. Oh my God.
Dreams do come true, kids.
Girl, speaking of dreams coming true, Amy Traden, I think we've officially made it because we have our first one-star review.
Oh officially. My gosh. I'm honored, truly.
That's how you know we fucking made it. It's hilarious. And did I give the person who left the review a quick goog? Yes, I did, because that's who I am. And it turns out that this person has never left anything more than a one-star review. And they have left it on true crime podcasts that are much more well-known and successful than ours. So, mama, I made it.
I'm weirdly super excited about that.
10,000%. Do you want me to read it? Shall I do a reading?
Yes. I didn't know if you had it handy, so I didn't want to put you on the spot. But I 100% want you to read it.
Yes.
Give it to me.
Cringe is the title. One star.
I love it already.
These are a couple of grown women who sound like Valley chicks and constantly say girl, all caps, in response to anything the other says. In place of, that's cool. It's girl, 3 exclamation points. It's all caps annoying. So hard to follow along when their voices are so distracting. So Garden Fairy 86, thank you for making us legitimate because we only have 5-star reviews, which people who don't know us may see it and think it's fake. So now you've given us a credibility. 2, girl does not mean that's cool. And I feel very sad for you that you've never been girled in your life.
Yeah.
What a sad life you lead. That's not what that means.
No.
Girl never means that's cool.
In fact, I would say it's very versatile and it has a lot of different meanings depending on the intonation. So
10,000%.
A little close-minded, but okay.
Yep.
I'm so like beaming for someone who just got...
Yeah, exactly.
Hardcore insulted. I'm like way too giddy about it. I'm like, yes, I feed on the hatred and the energy. Like, give it to me.
Oh, for sure.
It only makes me stronger.
I mean, let's be real. There's a certain gender that says chicks, and it's not female. So, you know.
That is very true. You know what?
You know.
We're not for everyone.
Absolutely not. We're not for everyone. So, if you're here with us, welcome to the girl fold. We embrace you. We adore you. We love you.
It's fucked up that he only made me want to say it more.
Absolutely.
Just as a fuck you to this guy. You just
girl,
put gasoline on the fire. Like, girl.
We salute you. Thank you for the 1-star review.
Oh my gosh. I love it. You know what? There are those people who just like are never happy with anything and they're never happy unless they're complaining.
Sure.
And I feel like this is one of those people.
Yeah, I guess so. But again, this lends us to credibility. So thank you.
Thank you, Garden Fairy, whatever.
86. Thanks, girl.
I love you so much.
I love you.
I have had people mention my Valley Girl voice before, but only in the sense of like, where did that come from? You're from Florida. You should not sound like you're from Southern California. And I'm like, I don't know. A child of the 90s? Like, that's it.
Am I fucked up that I don't think we have Valley Girl voices?
I didn't think so either until I was called out on it. And then I was like, oh, fuck. Do I have a Valley Girl voice? Apparently, yes.
I think you have an amazing voice, Amy. I love it.
Thank you. Same. I have some exciting news. It's not, you know, one star review worthy news, but
what is?
Nothing. I'm never getting over that. I'm beaming.
No, it's amazing.
If your intention was to hurt our feelings, you failed miserably. You did not.
You failed, girl.
Oh my God, I love you so, so much. I really can't. Oh, so good. So I am excited to announce that the companion podcast for BitCon was just released.
Yes.
It's called Creating a Con, and Johnny not only narrated it, but is also one of the producers, and he even took the photo that they use for the cover art.
Oh, that's a great photo.
Yeah. He's been working so hard, and I am so proud of him. It's currently subscription only right now under iHeart True Crime on Apple Podcast, but I believe it will be available for free everywhere on April 1st. So if you want to do a free trial, check it out. All the episodes are out now, or you can wait until April 1st when it's on Spotify and all other podcast platforms. But check it out. Highly recommended.
That is so exciting. I can't wait to listen.
I know. Me too. I haven't checked it out yet, but I'm going to, mainly because I have heard pretty much all of it in bits and pieces recorded in my apartment.
Yes, because he would take up our recording time because he would have to record.
Yes. We have to share a studio space and we do not have a sign-up sheet. So.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh my God. I love that so much. But I can't wait to tune in because that fucking doc was crazy.
It was crazy. And there is so much more to the story that they didn't include in it. So not only are you getting like behind the scenes stuff, you're getting so much more information about what went down.
I love it.
Crazy, crazy shit.
So either right now or April 1st. Don't be a fool and miss it. April 1st.
Hey, I like that. I'm doing a very quiet clap right now for Monique.
She's doing a golf clap. I love it.
I do a good golf clap.
Girl.
Girl, you're going to think of it now every single time.
Yeah. I love it, though. I girl my boyfriend. And he's like, yeah. Like, because he understands what that means. And it's never been that cool. Because that's not what that means.
No. It's like when you dude people, I dude everyone.
It's gender neutral.
Yes. Thank you. Any other exciting news on your front? Any recommendations for me for things to watch?
No, not really. Unfortunately, just really have just been continuing to watch Feud, Capote versus the Swans. It's fucking great. And just been backlogging some What Went Wrong episodes that I haven't listened to.
I love it. I did listen to their newest episode. I know we talked about it a little bit. It's amazing. I never watched Lost, yeah. But honestly, listening to the episode made me really want to watch it.
Watch like a season. Maybe three. Like, no more than that.
Okay. My favorite part might have been the fact that the polar bear apparently came about because it was, like, a throwaway joke by one of the cast members for, like, what should happen. And they were like, yeah, that's good. We're putting that in. And she was like,
brilliant.
No. Yeah. That was very clearly a joke. And they're like, no, we're running with it.
Love it.
Did you ever watch The Tourist? Question.
No. This is the Johnny Depp movie?
No. This is the show with Jamie Dornan of 50 no. Shades fame.
He has been being brought up into my life repeatedly recently for some reason, cosmically. I don't know what Jamie's trying to tell me.
I mean, probably because he's Irish and sexy as fuck. Possibly.
No, yeah.
So.
Not upset about it.
No. Boxes checked. So apparently the first season aired on HBO Max. I did not catch it when it was on there. The first season is on Netflix now, though, and Netflix picked up the second season. I actually watched this a couple weeks ago, but I didn't recommend it because it was another show that had an ambiguous ending. And I was like, I can't keep doing this to people. People need resolution.
Yeah.
So I didn't mention it. And then I realized that the second season actually comes out on Netflix today. So by the time this airs, the second season will be out. And basically it follows Jamie Dornan's character after he wakes up in a hospital after a car crash with amnesia. The second season takes place in Ireland. The first season took place in Australia. And it's amazing.
Oh, shit.
It was one of those shows that like every episode ended on a what the fuck moment. And I genuinely said what the fuck at the end of every episode. And then I was like, well, fuck, I have to watch another one now because what the fuck?
Oh, darn. How many episodes is it so far? At least season one?
I feel like it's a pretty short season. I want to say it's 8 episodes.
Okay. So like a standard HBO.
Yeah. They go by really quick. I honestly like binge it in like almost in one day. I think I like save the last 2 episodes for the next day or something.
Okay, cool.
So if you need a little break from your swan viewing.
I always like a break.
That's my recommendation for the week.
I love it.
I'm very excited to immediately start season 2 once we're done recording. I didn't mark my calendar or anything. I'm not like counting down to it. But yes, I 100% did and was.
Thanks for the rec. I can't wait to check that out.
Please do. I would love to hear your thoughts on it, gush about it with you.
For sure.
On that note, do you have a spooky, creepy, what the fuck paranormal story for me?
I have all the above, baby. Yes.
You always check all my boxes. I love it.
Girl. I love you.
This is going to be the most like girl-rific episode anyone's ever heard. And if you have a problem with it, you can blame Garden Fairy 86.
Thanks, Garden Fairy. Woo, woo.
This is a direct result of your actions, for the record.
All right, let's dive into it. Sources: hauntedhillstours.com, Ranker, collider.com, screenrant.com, unfakely.com, buzzfeed.com, newsweek.com, periergia.org, abc.es, which is España, Spain, and a news segment from the Spanish television program Telediario Adres. In 1991, Estefania Gutierrez Lázaro had a pretty normal life. The 14-year-old grew up in Vallecas, a neighborhood in the suburbs of southern Madrid, and came from a lower middle-class family where she was the oldest of her siblings, which included at least 2 younger sisters and 2 younger brothers. And like most 14-year-old girls, Estefania became really fascinated with the supernatural, regularly reading books on ghosts and the occult. Likely as a result, and again, not unlike most 14-year-old girls, Estefania had started to dabble with Ouija boards.
Oh, no.
Girl.
Girl, don't do it. It's bad news bears.
I did this shit all the time when I was in my youth. Now I'm like, I'm a mature woman and I've learned. There's this great line in Sweeney Todd. It's in one of the first songs where it's like, you are young. Life has been kind to you. You will learn. That's like what should go for like everyone fucking with a Ouija board as a, like a teen and a preteen.
Yes.
Just life has been kind to you. You're going to fucking learn because you're going to fuck around. And you're going to find out.
The realness of that.
Hopefully not to this extent.
Oh God. Okay.
Girl. We're checking all the boxes. One of Estefania's friends had recently lost her boyfriend in a tragic motorcycle accident and was eager to see if she could contact him in some way. Estefania's maternal grandfather had also passed away a few months earlier, so the girls decided to bring the Ouija board to school to see if they could pierce the veil. And by all accounts, everyone had already used a Ouija board before and were very comfortable and familiar with the rules and mechanics behind the supernatural device. So one day in March, one of the girls brought the board to school at Colegio Público Aragón de Vallecas, with the hopes of connecting with the deceased boyfriend. For whatever reason, there was no teacher present for the start of one of their periods. So the girls took the opportunity to run to the bathroom to conduct the secret seance. Estefania's sister, Marianela, also joined the group. However, she declined to participate in the game, opting to serve as a lookout instead. Important to note, despite using a Ouija board, they used an upside-down glass as a planchette, and the game got underway. And everything about the seance seemed to be very standard fare for a Ouija game. They asked the alleged spirits questions, and the glass would move on its own. At some point during the game, Marianela wanted to check in on how everything was going, but she couldn't open the door. Try as she might, the door just wouldn't budge. While it's not mentioned, I'm assuming that there weren't locks on the door of the bathroom, which would make sense because one, it's a school, and two, if there was a possibility of the door being locked, I don't think Marianela would have been in such a panic. After several unsuccessful attempts, Marianela flagged down a teacher named Dolores Molina for help. Molina burst into the bathroom and upon witnessing the occult scene, freaked the fuck out. She ripped the board away from the girls, broke it, and yelled at them to return to class.
No, you have to close the game.
Correct, Amy.
Oh, you fucked it up, faculty. God damn it.
Correct, Amy. And you definitely are never supposed to break or even like I read a thing that I was like burning boards. It's like, don't even fucking do that. Like, just leave it alone. The only other thing I heard is that you can bury it, but it's like, don't break it. Don't burn it. Put it in its box. Leave it the fuck alone. But correct, Amy. They did not close the game. Everyone present at the seance later confirmed that after Miss Molina broke the Ouija board, the glass they had been using as a planchette inexplicably filled up with a strange white smoke, at which point the glass exploded and the smoke rose and went into Estefania's nose and mouth.
Oh, no.
While some accounts claim that Estefania fainted or had a seizure at inhaling the mysterious vapor, Marianela says that her sister, as well as the rest of the seance participants, returned to class without incident. It wasn't until Estefania got home that things started to get weird. Her behavior suddenly changed. She started scratching the walls of her bedroom and making weird noises, including barking at her brothers. When her parents confronted her about her behavior, she told them that she didn't know why she was acting this way, but confided that she had started seeing ominous, shadowy figures in the middle of the night. She claimed that these evil forces were stalking her, keeping her up all night, and that whenever she saw the shadowy figures, she would behave this way. So I will say the last time I played Ouija, which I was in high school, I was about like 17, before I started playing it kind of very sporadically in the last couple of years, the girl whose house we did this at said that this happened to her, that she started seeing shadowy figures in her fucking house. Because while we did close the game, too much time went by. The game was open for too long. So it actually didn't matter when we closed the game. And that's where like the whole coconut thing came in, when I found out about the coconut. So this same thing happened to a girl that I know in a game that I played. Just random tidbit. Then the teen began to have seizures and became increasingly psychotic. In the weeks that followed, Estefania experienced insomnia and hallucinations, which in addition to the shadow people, included hearing terrifying voices, many of which she said came from the bathroom on the other side of her bedroom wall. Sometimes she went catatonic for 15 minutes or more. On multiple occasions, she attacked her siblings without any recollection of doing so after the episode had passed. She also laughed uncontrollably, talked incomprehensibly, or uttered only guttural noises. According to her mother, Estefania would speak in unknown languages, periodically foaming from the nose and mouth.
Jesus Christ.
Girl, I fucking know. What the fuck?
This is intense.
It's very intense, yes. Her seizures became more frequent and violent, and while Estefania's parents took her to multiple doctors and specialists, none of the medical professionals could determine a cause of her illness. While Estefania was not known to suffer from any mental illness, it was clear to everyone that she was not well. So she was eventually pre-diagnosed with epilepsy. It's important to note that Estefania's mother, Concepcion, did suffer from epilepsy. She had been diagnosed and treated long before anything with Estefania started happening. Given that epilepsy is believed to be genetic, I can see why she was pre-diagnosed as such, despite the fact that audio and visual hallucinations are not typical symptoms for epilepsy. While Estefania was treated for her diagnosis, her symptoms did not improve. And it wasn't just Estefania's behavior that was alarming. Unexplained things started happening in the Gutierrez home. On one occasion, Estefania and her mother were in the bathroom adjacent to the teen's bedroom when the bathroom door, which was wide open, suddenly closed and locked by itself, trapping the two inside. They called out for help, and when Estefania's father, Maximo, tried to open the door, he too was unable to open it. After several attempts, and just as he was about to kick the door down, the door suddenly opened on its own. Some accounts mention the Gutierrezes sought the help of a priest, but that clearly didn't do much. Estefania wasn't getting any better, and she knew it. On one occasion, she requested that her father's family not be informed of her imminent death, and she said that she needed a photo of herself with her father, Maximo, inside the coffin once she passed.
Holy fuck.
Girl.
She's just, like, writing herself off already. She's like, this is it. I'm done.
Yeah.
That's fucking scary.
I know, girl. In August of 1991, just 5 months after the Ouija board game, Estefania suffered a severe seizure, after which she fell into a coma and was taken to Gregorio Marañón Hospital. Despite doctors' best efforts to revive the teen, Estefania Gutierrez Lázaro died 3 hours later.
What the fuck?
Girl, I know. It's going to get crazier, if you can believe it.
How?
Girl.
Okay.
Come on this ride with me. It's fucking nuts.
Always. Strapped in.
What's crazier is that the medical report filled out by coroner Pedro Cabezas cited her death as, quote, sudden and suspicious, end quote.
This is a medical professional.
Yeah. You know the amount of shit they've seen? So Estefania was buried as per Catholic ritual, and her parents opted to keep all of their daughter's belongings and room exactly as they were when she was alive. So Concepcion cleaned her daughter's bedroom and locked it. And for a few days, everything was fine. But the strange phenomena that had been occurring at the Gutierrez apartment did not end with Estefania's death. Shortly after the funeral, there was some light poltergeist activity. Doors opened and closed on their own, and small objects moved by unseen forces. Then the family started hearing noises coming from Estefania's room. When Mr. and Mrs. Gutierrez would open her door to investigate, they would find the room empty, but filled with billowing cold air, despite the window being closed and there being no air blowing outside. Before long, fresh scratches started appearing on the walls, the same types of scratches Estefania would make when she was still alive and behaving erratically. These unexplained incidents justifiably freaked out the entire family. So mom and dad made a steadfast rule for the household. 1. No one was allowed to enter Estefania's room. And 2. To ensure that, their deceased daughter's room was to remain locked at all times. Despite all this, the sounds from the girl's room continued. And night after night, Maximo and Concepcion kept finding the door to their daughter's bedroom inexplicably open. But, which I can't imagine. I can't. It's already like, your daughter's fucking dead.
Yeah.
Because that's not enough. We're dealing with all of this shit on fucking top of it. My God.
My gut instinct is to say burn it down, but I feel like it's attached to you at this point. It's not going anywhere.
Amy, it's like you've been doing a paranormal true crime podcast for like 3 years.
This is my first rodeo. Like, I'm familiar.
You know, I'm kind of a big deal. I know what the fuck's up. But as time went by, the unexplained activity increased and the hauntings became more frequent and more violent. It wasn't long before the rest of the family also started seeing a mass of looming shadow people, the same kinds their daughter had talked about when she was still alive. Concepcion even claimed that one of these dark specters attacked her in her sleep. She said, quote, "I felt pressure on top of me, but there was no one around. I said to my husband, 'There's someone here.' I then felt a pair of hands grab my feet and then grab my hand, which were uncovered by the blanket," end quote. Which, again, is not what sleep paralysis is.
No.
You don't feel like
things grab at you.
Yes, exactly. Despite this, Concepcion claimed that the bulk of the paranormal activity was concentrated in the bathroom and would often occur at the exact time that Estefania had slipped into a coma that would ultimately claim her life, leading the family to believe that the hauntings were directly tied to their deceased daughter. Concepcion even claimed that she could often hear Estefania's voice calling her from inside the bathroom saying, "Mom."
No.
I cannot imagine any of this.
Like, that's the last thing you need on top of your grief.
And I don't know if you've ever had someone pass who lived with you, or even like a pet who passed. Like, I've definitely heard like their voice, or like their like meow or their bark. And I don't know if it's just like you're just used to it, that you kind of like manifested in your head or whatnot. But this is, honestly, I think it's just like kind of cruel. Like, it's just, I couldn't imagine losing your daughter in a really awful, inexplicable way, to the point that the coroner's like, "Girl, I don't know what the fuck to tell you. So I'm just going to write nothing on this fucking report."
It's suspicious. Yeah.
You know? And then you have all this shit going on, and then you hear your daughter's fucking voice calling you from the fucking bathroom. I can't imagine.
No.
So this bathroom was added to the growing list of rooms the other children were forbidden from entering for their safety. While these specific instances of paranormal phenomena can't be confirmed, the family alleges that they continued to suffer terrifying and unexplainable occurrences on a near daily basis within their Vallecas home for the next year.
No. No. Like, fill the house with coconuts. Something. I can't.
Girl, I know. Now, I can literally hear Donna screaming, "Why don't you just fucking move?" Which is a fair question. But a psychic had told Concepcion that moving wouldn't solve their paranormal problem, as their supernatural activity was directly tied to them and would just follow them wherever they went. It's not unheard of for spirits to attach themselves to people. They attach themselves either to people that they want to know because they are intrigued by the person, because they either like or very much dislike the living being, or, and I would imagine more commonly, they attach themselves to people they know because they want to watch over them, give them information, are unwilling to let go, or have some sort of unresolved issues with the living. So despite the fact that all of this scary poltergeist activity increased after their daughter's death, and it was no doubt connected to Estefania, her parents knew that it couldn't be her causing all of it. For one, the presence was scary and menacing, not at all like their daughter. And two, all of this crazy shit started while Estefania was still alive. So what, or more importantly, who could be the one responsible for tormenting the Gutierrez family? Remember how I mentioned that Estefania's maternal grandfather had passed away a few months before she played the Ouija board and she was hoping to connect with him during the game? Well, turns out that homeboy was a real piece of work. Apparently, he and Concepcion had a huge falling out over money, and as a result, the relationship between father and daughter became extremely turbulent, to the point that shortly before his passing from senile dementia, the mean-spirited patriarch's dying wish was to, quote, "make his family's lives impossible from beyond the grave," end quote. Fucking yikes.
What the fuck?
Girl, just follow the light. Go into the light, girl.
Yeah.
let it go.
Nobody hurts you like family. Fuck.
Oh, 10,000%. But guess what? You're dead. You can't do anything with the money. Money means nothing. You're dead. Move on.
He's really spiteful. Like, you took your granddaughter with you? For what?
Well, exactly what I'm going to say. Leading the family to believe that not only was the grandfather's restless, angry spirit behind at least some of the paranormal activity, but that it was he who had possessed their daughter when she inhaled the mysterious smoke during the seance and taken her life.
Grandpa! Why are you going to do me like that? That's fucked up.
I know. You're a fucking grandpa. That's supposed to be like a great job.
Yeah.
You're like loved and adored and you don't have to care for a kid.
No vaping in the bathroom. Get out of here.
Thank you. The family continued to be terrorized by unseen forces occupying their home until the morning of November 27th, 1992, no longer able to take it and in desperate need of help, Estefania's father, Maximo, called the police.
Wow.
Girl.
When you're calling the police in for some weird paranormal shit, like, you know it's gotten bad.
You know, one. Two, especially after doing this podcast, I want a paper trail of fucking everything. I want a record of everything.
Yeah. Smart.
Because when I realized I can't alibi myself a lot of the time, I was like, oh, that's not great. You know? So I should probably have records of shit of like my existence and where I'm at. Just a tip for life.
It's helpful. Yeah.
You know. The distraught man told the commissioner that they needed help because the paintings and crucifixes in their house were going around in circles on their own and that there was a tall, dark, hairless figure standing in the hall waiting for them.
No.
Literally my fucking nightmare.
I don't think I've ever heard of them spinning before. Like, turning upside down is one thing, sure.
Yeah.
Damn, grandpa's really fucking spiteful. Shit.
Girl. I mean, but also, like, sometimes old people, they've, like, lived a long time and they're just, like, can't let it go.
Yeah. They hold a grudge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, bro, this happened a billion years ago. Get the fuck over it. Who cares? You have senile dementia. How do you even fucking remember this? Get the fuck out.
Right?
A short while later, two squad cars arrived at the apartment at 8 Luis Marin Street. And the first thing that struck the chief inspector, Jose Pedro Negri, as odd was that despite it being frigidly cold out, it was the end of November after all, the entire Gutierrez family was waiting for the police outside. Concepcion was even breastfeeding a baby when they arrived. These people were very clearly scared and did not want to be in that apartment. Negri tried to calm the family down before he and the three other agents entered the home with the Gutierrezes. The family explained to Inspector Negri how the crucifixes throughout the house moved uncontrollably and that a huge dark figure watched them from the hallway. While interviewing the family, the door of a, quote, perfectly closed armoire, end quote, violently opened and closed, quote, in a sudden and totally unnatural way, end quote. Despite the room being locked and no one being allowed in, when police entered Estefania's room, they found the girl's room in shambles, with many of the posters appearing to have been scratched and clawed by some kind of animal. The Gutierrez parents told authorities that anyone who went into their late daughter's room was subjected to being pushed around by an invisible force. While Inspector Negri and two of the officers were in the master bedroom with Mr. Gutierrez, they suddenly heard a loud bang that sounded like it came from outside the bedroom's balcony. They then heard what sounded like a large and heavy boulder roll across the balcony's tiled floor. When they opened the balcony doors to investigate, they found nothing and no one. No boulder or signs of anything that the men could identify as the source of the sound. The officers witnessed several unexplained phenomena while making the house call. They saw a mysterious substance stuck to the furniture that appeared to be a brownish-red color, which they attributed to drool. Which I'm like, what?
What
kind of drool do you have?
you need to go to the doctor.
You literally took the words right out of my mouth. It's like, girl, there is some issues with your mouth. You know, figure that shit out. While they were conducting the investigation, the officers allegedly saw the stains begin to spread. And in something right out of The Exorcist, all four officers saw a crucifix on Estefania's wall move on its own, with the crucified Jesus separating from his cross until it snapped and fell to the floor in the middle of the room. No, thank you. And I quit.
What the actual fuck? Yeah, I don't want to have to file that report.
And again, this is 1992.
Oh.
So, like, there's no wild shit. I don't even know how the fuck you do this.
No.
What the fuck? At that, the policeman told the inspector that if their presence in the home was not mandatory, they would prefer to wait in the street while the chief inspector finished his investigation.
Correct. I'll be at the station, actually. Thanks. I'm good.
Yeah. Does someone need Dunkin' Donuts? I need like a bear claw so hard right now. I'm just going to go do that. You let me know when you're done.
Yep.
Inspector Negri later said, quote, "Only one partner stayed with me," end quote. The last supernatural event occurred a year later in 1993 on All Saints Day. A framed photograph of Estefania fell off an end table and burst into flames.
Grandpa, get the fuck out here.
Girl. Now here's the thing. While it is important to note that no one actually witnessed the incident in real time, the girl's mother found the frame after the fact, lying face down on the floor. And when she turned it over, she saw that the photograph of her daughter had been scorched. But curiously, neither the frame, the protective glass, nor any of the surrounding objects on the floor had been damaged.
Wait, so literally the photo inside the glass?
Yes.
Again, you can't burn it down, but I don't know. Coconut dress, something.
I mean, you know, let's get some Cocoa Life water situation. Like, let's gotta fucking do something. What the fuck? The Gutierrez family eventually sold their apartment and moved away. The tenants who later occupied the space said they never experienced anything strange, and there haven't been any reports of paranormal activity in the building since. It is unclear whether the hauntings have followed the Gutierrez family. So, obligatory devil's advocate. The first one, most obvious one, most of this is hearsay. The majority of the facts come from the family, but very specifically Concepcion, who, again, has been diagnosed with epilepsy, which, while there isn't any symptom that appears usually in epilepsy of audio or visual hallucinations, it is a thing that, you know, there's a asterisk, I guess, to possibly to her recollections of things. She and the family have been interviewed about the case multiple times and have appeared on multiple TV shows over the years. But in case you think that maybe she's making this up as a way to capitalize on her daughter's untimely death, it's very clear that they believe something paranormal was happening in their home. Concepcion contacted a long string of paranormal experts and investigators during those turbulent years, doing anything she could to rid herself of the curse she was convinced lived inside her house. Some of these supposed experts confirmed that, yes, there were indeed malevolent forces in the home, with one self-professed psychic from Sevilla offering to exorcise the domicile of any evil spirits for the paltry sum of $2,000.
Oh!
Or the equivalent of 3 months' pay for Maximo. AKA, these people are not exactly profiting from this. And while two of Estefania's brothers, Ricardo and Maximiliano, have offered contradictory statements claiming that their sister wasn't into the occult, which, I'm sorry, how would you know? Like, my brothers don't know much about my shit, realistically.
Yeah, I didn't invite you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that they don't recall any paranormal things that happened and only believed they were happening because their mother told them so, also admitted to having a fuzzy memory of the time due to the fact that they were still quite young. Not only that, it wasn't only Concepcion who talked about the various paranormal goings-on at the Gutierrez home. But several of Estefania's friends and family members went on the record to confirm their own eyewitness accounts. Then there is the biggest piece of evidence to lend credence to this whole situation. The police report.
I was just going to say, dude, there's like official record of this.
That's right. When Chief Inspector Negri and his team answered the call of a paranormal disturbance at 8 Louis Marin Street on November 27th, 1992, they documented their experience in an official police report. The document, complete with official stamps, details the loud and unidentifiable noises protruding from empty areas of the house, the wardrobe violently swinging its doors open right in front of the officers in an, quote-unquote, unnatural way, with nobody inside, the Jesus figure being torn from its cross, and large brown stains appearing and spreading in various odd places in the house. Ultimately, investigators could find no concrete explanation for what happened at the Gutierrez home, concluding that it was a, quote, situation of mystery and rarity, end quote. That is what is literally written in the official police report. While Inspector Negri's file has been heavily scrutinized over the years, neither he nor any of the other officers present have ever recanted their statements. Obviously, this kind of official document is extremely rare when it comes to paranormal activity, especially from members of the police or military, who normally are not easily duped and tend to be more logical than, hey, this house is haunted. Which makes the Vallecas case, as it has become known, especially unusual, in that it is the first, and from what I can find, only time in Spanish history that the police have officially reported paranormal activity relating to a case. As a result, the Vallecas case had become one of the most well-known stories of supposed paranormal activity in the history of Spain, often drawing comparisons to the Amityville Horror here in the United States. The story took on a mythical and almost urban legend-like status, with people embellishing the story over time. For instance, no two accounts can agree on what age Estefania was when she passed. Some say she was 14, others 15, others 18. I went off of the Spanish television program that interviewed her family, where the reporter said that the girl had been 14 when she passed. There are various inconsistencies throughout the numerous retellings. Several claim that it was a nun who came across the girls playing the Ouija board and destroyed it. But Estefania didn't go to a Catholic school. She went to a public school. And everyone present at the seance agrees that a teacher named Dolores Molina was the one who found them and broke the board. And I couldn't find anything about her being a nun. But nuns make for a better creepy story, obviously. Others have added the detail that the shadowy figure was that of an elderly man, likely to tie in the narrative that it was indeed Estefania's grandfather who was terrorizing the family, while others escalate the paranormal activity to include things like family pets being thrown around the apartment. Among the many who have put their own stamp on the infamous case is filmmaker Paco Plaza, who in 2017 released the critically acclaimed Spanish horror film Veronica. Loosely based on the Vallecas case, Veronica follows a 15-year-old girl who is accidentally possessed by a demon while attempting to communicate with her dead father via the Ouija board, and the 3 days of escalating paranormal activity that follow. While the film is by no means meant to be a type of documentary of the Vallecas case, as Plaza has taken many creative liberties, the film begins with audio of what sounds like a real-life phone call to the police reporting paranormal activity, and ends with the police report and realistic photos from a criminal investigation. And that is the story of the alleged possession, death, and subsequent haunting of Estefania Gutierrez Lázaro, the most famous haunted house story in Spain, and the only time an official police report documented paranormal activity in Spanish history.
Oh my God, I love that so much.
Right?
I'm speechless. What the fuck?
Jinx. Yes.
That was so crazy.
And like, I'm certain you have never watched like Spanish news before because you wouldn't understand it. You don't speak Spanish.
Correct.
But I grew up watching it. And Spanish news is fucking crazy. Like, they show exorcisms. They show executions. They don't trigger warning you at the fuck all. They show all sorts of wild shit. So when I was watching this clip where they're interviewing her family, they have some, like, two paranormal psychics who are, like, one of them is, like, claiming to have the grandfather's body jump into her, and then the other one's trying to, like, exorcise the demon. And this is, like, on the fucking evening news, and you're like, what the fuck is this? It's so disturbing and fucked up. It's wild. Can you imagine just, like, that's the fucking news all the time?
No.
Yeah. It's fucking crazy.
That's insane. I have to admit, your correct Spanish pronunciations for everything was very titillating for me. I love it. So exotic.
I got you. You know, that's what the guys in college, when they would find out that I was Cuban and had previously, before knowing that fact, had zero interest in me, all of a sudden I became really exotic because.
Because you can speak Spanish, of course. Yes.
I guess. I remember there's this one guy who he said, like, this is verbatim. He's like, you know, before 20 minutes ago, I thought you were just some white girl. But now that I know you're Cuban, you got these, like, amazing legs and lips. I'm like, homie, they're the same legs and lips from fucking 20 minutes ago. This is not endearing me to you.
People are ridiculous.
They are.
That was such a good story, though. I loved that so much.
Thank you.
Don't fuck with a Ouija board.
Don't fuck with a Ouija board. And if you do, close that fucking game. Keep it short. Keep it cute. Keep it creepy. And close that shit.
I would have freaked out when I saw the teacher break the board. I would have been like, oh, yes. Well, you've just fucked us all now. Great.
Great. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
I'll take the F, but this is bullshit. I'm going to die now.
I was like, you can expel me because we're all fucked after this. Thanks.
Yeah. Close that fucking game, girl. I did not get the chance to watch Veronica. I believe it is on Netflix, and it has, like, an 88 Rotten Tomatoes rating.
Oh.
It's apparently really great. And I guess it was so successful that a few years later they came out with a prequel to it of one of the characters in it.
I might have to check that out because despite it being in Spanish, I love a good subtitle, as anyone who knows me will know. So I don't mind.
Same. I just saw a thing. It's so funny you say that. I just saw a thing that apparently most millennials watch things with subtitles or, like, with captions. And I was like, yeah, that's me.
Yeah. I love it.
Yes.
Immediately, I will notice when they're not on and I have to go turn them on.
You're like, what is this?
A lot of times when I'm in a movie theater, I'm like, oh, God, there's no fucking captions. What they say, I missed it. They're mumbling.
Like, literally same. Like, my Gen X boyfriend doesn't fucking use subtitles. And it's me being like, hi, can I? Can you put the subtitles, please?
I, like, also thank like you. To read while I watch a TV show. It's, you know, multitasking.
Yeah, but apparently the movie's won a ton of awards. And again, while it isn't Estefania's story, it is very inspired by the case.
I love it. I'll look that up after I binge watch The Tourist.
Oh, girl, yes. And the Spanish, they do some great fucking horror movies. The Orphanage is one of the scariest things I've ever seen in my life.
Honestly, I feel like the last time I started a Spanish horror movie, I don't think I even finished it because I honestly got so freaked out.
Yeah, it'll fuck your life up.
That I was like, I don't care how this ends. Like, I'm out.
Yeah, there was, I was talking with someone recently who was saying how they, like, really fucked up horror movies and that they had a list, like, on their phone. And the last one on there was The Skin I Live In or The Skin I'm In, the Pedro Almodovar movie. And I was like, okay, if you like fucked up movies, move that one right to the fucking top because that's the most fucked up movie I've ever seen in my fucking life. Like, ever. It's incredible. But that's a one and done. And that was yet another one that I remember being like, does anyone want to go see this psychological horror Spanish movie with me? No, I'll just go watch it by myself in the movie theater. Thanks. And then I was just like, what the fuck is this? It was so fucked up. If anyone has seen this movie, jump into my DMs. I want to talk all about it because it's so fucked up.
I'm too afraid. I'm probably not going to watch it. Full disclosure.
That's fair. It's not gory.
I don't do well with tense moments, weirdly. Like, if there's a lot of quiet and you're afraid there's going to be a jump scare, I actually don't do well with that.
No, it's not that. Like, truly, the best way to describe it is just it's fucked up.
Okay.
It's like one of the most fucked up things I've ever. It's up there. I think it might be the most fucked up thing I've ever seen.
Wow. Did you see Bone Tomahawk, though? That's the real question.
I did not. But that's super gory, though. Like, that's different.
It was so awful.
Aren't they just, like, scalping and shit?
So yeah. Awful. But, oh, my God. It was so awful. I will never recover. You kind of tackled the carrot on that one. Now, as fucked up as it is, I kind of want to see it. Maybe in the middle of the day when I'm in a good mood, I'll check it out.
Yeah. Sometimes I do that. Like, I remember when I first watched Haunting of Hill House the first way through, I remember kind of starting to binge it and being like, it's getting kind of dark. I think I should save this for tomorrow.
Maybe I should put something else on. Like, no.
Yeah.
No, I get that. I am totally the person that if I go see a scary movie in the movie theater because I hate jump scares so much, like, I don't cover my eyes, but I will plug my ears. I've plugged my ears through like half of a movie before.
I do the watching through the spread fingers of my hand in front of my face.
Okay.
That's how I watch. Yeah. So there's some shield between me, my face, and the horrible thing happening.
I could see the fucked up shit, but I just don't want to hear it. There's something just like so visceral about sounds for me.
Yeah. That's why they use them.
Yeah. I fucking loved that story. That was so good. That was an extra creepy,
right?
Haunting, ghosty story. With, like, kind of a murder.
You know?
Speaking of, are you ready to dive into our true crime story this week?
I'm fucking ready, girl. Let's do it. Let's do it, baby!
Okay. So, we've had a couple of light weeks, but now we're back to our regularly scheduled trauma.
I fucking love you! Oh, my God. You know what? Fuck a golf clap.
Yay. Thank you.
That's incredible. That was incredible.
I'm glad you enjoyed that.
Don't ever change. I fucking adore you.
I wrote that for you.
I know you did. I love you.
I love you. All right. So trigger warnings for mentions of assault, rape, child sexual abuse, bestiality, suicide, and possible inadvertent cannibalism.
Okay, so all of it.
So like all of it. And like murder, obviously. That being said, I am not going to go into a lot of detail.
Great.
So a lot of these trigger warnings are literally just like one sentence where I say that happened.
We're mentioning it and we're moving on. Yep.
But, you know, it's there. So do with that information what you will. Sources. The podcast Serial Killers, the episode titled The Berlin Butcher, murderpedia.org, Chapter 7 of the book Crime and Criminal Justice in Modern Germany, thetruecrimedatabase.com, and good old Wikipedia. So today I'm going to tell you about Karl Grossmann, a.k.a. the Berlin Butcher, a.k.a. a real piece of shit. Grossmann was born in Neuruppin, Germany in 1863 to a working class family and was one of seven children.
Damn.
Not much is known about his early childhood, but it was generally believed to be unremarkable. In 1878, Grossmann left school at the age of 14 to work at a textile factory to help provide for his family. And 2 years later, he moved to Berlin in search of work with better pay. In Berlin, he worked a variety of short-lived jobs, including working as a butcher's apprentice. He reportedly did well in these jobs, but seemed to particularly excel in his work as a butcher, which, if you're thinking, that sounds like a red flag, then you'd be correct. Because this is definitely a Chekhov's cleaver situation.
Mm-hmm.
When he was 19 years old, he was drafted into the military, but was released from service due to a hernia. Afterwards, he returned to Berlin and found work there and in nearby rural areas as an agricultural laborer. But in 1884, a 20-year-old Grossmann received his first criminal charge and was sentenced to 3 days in jail for begging. And that was just the start. After that, he spent most of his life serving short sentences for petty crimes such as begging, theft, vagrancy, and crimes against decency, which I didn't really know what that entailed. So apparently these are so-called victimless crimes that can include anything from sex work, drug use, gambling, pornography, etc.
Oh, okay.
I know. It was one of those things I was like, I've heard that so much, and I never actually stopped to consider what that actually meant or entailed.
I would have thought it was like a flasher or something.
Yeah, I feel like that probably would fall into that category too, even though I would argue that there is a victim in that situation.
10,000%. Yes.
These petty crimes were common in Germany at the time, though. And whenever he was caught, he'd just be thrown in jail for a few nights, then released without any serious repercussions. Then things started to escalate. And in 1896, Grossman was charged with unnatural sexual assault of a sheep.
Jesus.
Yeah. You gotta be hard up, man. Leave the sheep alone.
Leave him alone.
He didn't do anything to you.
Yeah. Just.
Yeah.
No, I don't understand that. I hear about it and I don't understand it.
No. The following year, he was convicted of sexually assaulting a 12-year-old girl.
Ugh.
The year after that, he raped two young girls, aged 10 and 4, one of whom was badly injured in the assault, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison as a result.
However?
I mean, they let him out after his fucking 15 years. Yeah.
Oh, so he actually at least did do the 15
he
years.
He did his 15 years, yes.
Okay. It wasn't like, it's 15 years, but like 3 months later, like, you know, he's fine.
No, he did do his 15 years, but like, I'm sorry. If you get life for that. Like, you don't need to be out
for
on
sure.
the streets if this is now your sexual assault offense against a child. Like, no. Bye.
Yeah. That kid's fucked up forever. You're an asshole. Fuck you.
Yes. There were a few sources that said one of the girls died. But what I would consider my most reputable source did not say that. So I have a feeling that, and I feel like if you killed someone, you would get more time for that.
I would hope.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But I would hope. By the time he was released from prison, around 1914, World War I was just beginning. And the Germany that the now 50-year-old Grossman returned to was very different from the one he'd left. Although he was exempt from the draft due to his criminal record, most of the country's young men were off fighting. And the millions of women left behind were now responsible for not only running the household, but also finding a way to support their families, which was no easy task. As the war continued, it became harder and harder for women to find ways to survive. Even after the war ended in 1918, the country was still experiencing a severe economic depression. Many women had lost their husbands, and their work opportunities were limited, especially for those in rural areas. As a result, many of these women traveled to Berlin to try to find work, and many of them found themselves in low-income neighborhoods, such as the Silesian train station district where Grossman was now living. The neighborhood was often a place for people with nowhere else to go, and was frequently home to sex workers and people living with drug addictions. Despite the devastating war years and the even worse period that followed, though, Grossman never seemed to struggle for money. Although it's unclear exactly how he was supporting himself, it's possible that he just had an edge as a man in a job market saturated by women, or that his experience as a butcher gave him a skill set that many of his female counterparts didn't have. But whatever the reason, he continued to thrive, and by late 1919, had established a nice little life for himself. He lived in a small apartment and became quite well known in the neighborhood as a man willing to loan money to his neighbors in need, and as a result, seemed to be generally well-liked. He also had a habit of offering his help specifically to women in need, however.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, offering them clothes, a meal, a bed to sleep in for a few nights, or even work as a housekeeper. And for many of them, these were a godsend. But for Grossman, this wasn't just generosity.
Mm-hmm.
He knew these women were vulnerable, and that once they crossed the threshold of his apartment, he could demand almost anything in exchange for the most basic items, and it's no surprise that everything he offered came with a price. And that price, more often than not, was sex.
Ugh.
Yep. Dozens of women agreed to have sex with him in exchange for his quote-unquote generosity.
That is so gross.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of women who'll have sex with you. But clearly that's not what he wants. He wants the, like, power and the, like, that's what he wants.
Correct, Monique.
Ugh.
I know. It's going to get worse, obviously.
Of course, yeah. It's Amy's story.
It's
of course.
My story, yeah. But these transactions rarely ended well. One woman said that when she arrived in the dingy apartment, Grossman poured her a cup of coffee. She took a few sips, and the next thing she knew, she was waking up in Grossman's bed with her arms and legs tied to the bed frame.
Stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. I can't even imagine.
No.
There was a throbbing pain between her legs, and she realized that she'd been drugged and raped. Although he let her go afterwards.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. I mean, knowing where this story goes, I would it's fucked up, but I would honestly like be like, thank you. I will leave right now. That's all I ask. Right. Just let me go. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
So although he let her go, she didn't report the incident to the police. And unfortunately, this wasn't the first or the last time Grossman would commit such an offense. And as time went on, these interactions started becoming more violent, and he began to beat the women he tied to his bed. Although his neighbors frequently heard his victims' cries and the sounds of violence coming from his apartment, they never intervened or reported what they'd heard to authorities.
What the fuck?
Yes, which partly gets chalked up to the bystander effect. Also, apparently, this was due in part to German cultural norms at the time. It was considered inappropriate to interfere with a man's domestic life, particularly when it came to women. And there was just also this general acceptance of violence against women.
Yeah, it's called all of fucking history, but like...
Correct. The sound of a woman screaming wasn't exactly shocking, especially in a rougher part of the city like the Silesian train station district. Although it's likely that his behavior was whispered about in the neighborhood, most people believed that what someone did behind closed doors was nobody's business but their own, and his actions were never treated as criminal. It seemed people just accepted that he had some unsavory practices and were only bothered when things got too noisy. They didn't care whether the women in his apartment were safe, just that it was quiet.
Can you fucking imagine?
It was so infuriating to read all of this. Like, can you imagine hearing like a woman screaming and like the sounds of a struggle and a fight and then going dead silent? And instead of being like, I think somebody just got murdered, you're like, thank fuck, I can get a few hours of sleep now.
I can enjoy my talkie now.
Yes.
I remember years ago, I heard noises from my neighbors and I was like, oh my God, is a woman like being attacked? And she was just having sex. And I was like, good for you. It's 1 p.m. during the week. Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
I salute you.
Get that D, girl.
But if that was not the case, absolutely. Or no, I don't know. I don't know if there was a D or a V or an operated device. I don't know. She's on grand old time. But, you know, God bless her. But if it was not that, I would have reported the fuck out of that shit.
Good. That's the correct response.
Mm-hmm. Not been like, I'm trying to watch The Simpsons. Could you just like tone it down, please?
That's not too much trouble.
Please and thank you.
Yeah, that's why I recommend that when you are in the act of passion, which does sometimes sound like you're dying, I understand, trust me, you should yell like positive things. Like, yes, I think that's...
Keep going.
So everyone, just keep like going. That. Oh my God. Thank
I
you.
I consent.
Something, yes. Something to let the people know who might be listening.
Yeah.
That everything's okay and you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah. Because we're in New York City, baby. We're all on top of each other.
And you hear,
gonna
some,
hear
shit.
Some shit. Facts.
Jinx, I love you.
Facts.
It also didn't help that none of his victims ever reported any of his actions to the police. This was due in part to the fact that many of the women who visited his apartment weren't sex workers, yet had agreed to trade sexual favors for food and shelter, which put them in a precarious position. Because at this time, although sex work was tolerated in many German cities, sex workers had to officially register with the police and undergo regular medical examinations. If they notified the police, the women would have had to officially register as a sex worker, and it's likely they didn't want to go through that, since once they were registered, it was often difficult for women to find adequate housing or to return to other forms of employment. Another reason was because German citizens were required by law to register their address with the government, and the women who lived at Grossman's apartment were technically living there illegally. So even if they wanted to report him to the police, they would be risking a fine that they just couldn't afford. So they chose to keep what happened to themselves instead. By the end of 1919, things escalated once again, and violent sex no longer satisfied Grossman. He didn't just want to sexually dominate women. Now he wanted to kill them. It's not clear exactly what caused the shift. It's possible that he just accidentally went too far once and ended up killing someone, or he may have always fantasized about it.
Sure.
Either way, once Grossman started, he didn't stop. While he'd previously had women coming and going from his apartment on the regular, now his quote-unquote guests never seemed to leave. If neighbors noticed the sudden change, they, once again, didn't seem to care. They frequently heard the violence coming from his apartment, but when it suddenly went silent, they were more relieved at the peace and quiet than worried about the safety of the women in there. For the women, once they crossed the threshold of Grossman's apartment, he immediately attacked. He would tie them up and rape them, then strangle them to death. Although this too escalated, and instead of strangling them, he started to beat them to death with his bare hands.
Jesus Christ.
I can't even imagine. That's why I was like, it sucks so hard, but like, just let me go. I'll survive. I'll figure it out. I don't want this to be my fate.
Also, just, I understand, like, you don't want to get involved in shit.
But like, come on.
But also, like, that whoever that is happening to is somebody's kid. Like, they're, someone gives a fuck about them.
Yes. A lot of times they were mothers whose husbands had died in the war, who couldn't feed their kids. Like, it's like, so fucked.
And just being like, well, that's not my business. Like, that's somebody's business, though.
Yes. It's the police's, like, business. Just let them know.
Yes.
Give them a fucking heads up. Anonymously.
No one's asking you to be a fucking hero.
Thank you.
Go call the cops and be like, some wild shit's happening here.
Thank you. I can't believe, I guess probably noise complaints weren't a thing at this time, but like, I would have called in a noise complaint at least to be like, it's noisy as fuck next door. Can you just go like make sure everything's on the up and up, or tell him to shut the fuck up, please?
Yeah.
Once he'd kill them, though, he couldn't just carry the bodies out of the busy apartment building. So he decided to dismember them so they would be easier to dispose of, which, because of his work as a butcher, was a task he was more than familiar with. After breaking down the bodies into smaller parts, he would burn some of the pieces in his apartment oven, then wrap the rest in brown paper, just like any other cut of meat, and walk them right out the door. Holding the packages close to his chest, he would casually walk through the crowded streets in town till he reached one of Berlin's waterways. Once there, he would throw the packages in the water. And because at that time, Berlin's waterways were generally filled with trash and the occasional dead body, no one noticed the addition of a few brown paper-wrapped packages. By 1920, he was bringing home women multiple times a week.
Oh my God. Severe escalation.
Yes. It is unclear whether or not he murdered all of these women he was bringing home. It seems like even up till the point where he gets caught, some of them are leaving and getting away. But still, even if he's bringing home three women a week and two of them are getting away, one is too many to be murdering. So.
Yeah, absolutely. My God.
All of whom were just hoping to trade sex for a little money or food, unaware of the horrible fate that lay in store for them. At some point, Grossman's neighbors noticed a foul smell coming from his apartment. But when they finally confronted him about it, he just told them that he'd had some chicken that had spoiled in the summer heat. And as shocking as it may sound, they believed him.
Of course. This is the most, like, not, I don't want to be involved bullshit I've ever heard in my life.
Correct. Also, the building was overcrowded and poorly ventilated, so it wasn't uncommon for various offensive smells to be present. When I read this detail, though, I immediately thought of Queen Grace, because she told us that the closest thing to the smell of a dead body is rotting chicken meat.
Yep.
And I was like, this guy fucking knew. He fucking knew. Yep. He's a butcher. He's I'm sure he's dealt with rotting meat before. Like, he was like, oh, I fucking got the perfect cover story. Right in my back pocket.
Yep.
If anyone asks.
Yep.
So once again, his neighbors ignored this glaring red flag, and Grossman was free to continue his killing spree and dumping the remains of his victims into the river. However, it should be noted at that time, Berlin was still experiencing food shortages, and meat in particular was not only hard to come by, but very expensive when it was available. butchers were constantly losing business and were more than willing to accept meat from wherever or whoever they could get it from. No questions asked.
Is this literally going to turn into fucking Sweeney Todd?
Yes.
Girl!
Allegedly. Possibly.
Okay.
Unconfirmed, but highly likely.
Jaws on the floor.
I know. Monique's face right now. I was just going to say, jaw drop. Just shocked.
Oh my God.
I know. Again, although it was never officially confirmed, authorities believed it was very likely that Grossman, realizing he could profit from his kills, began selling the best cuts of his victims to the local butchers. Not only would this solve his issue of disposing of the bodies, but it allowed him to make a few extra bucks to entice more vulnerable women to his home. I know. Monique, I know.
I cannot. And like, if when this eventually comes out and you patronized this establishment and it's like, oh, by the way, like that, like ground beef, probably like lady leg. What goes through your head being like, were my hamburgers a fucking person? Were they people burgers?
Seriously. I would just, at that point, I'd be like, I don't even want to know. I don't even want to know. Please nobody investigate this because I really do not want to know that I ate a person unintentionally.
Yeah. I'd be like vegan for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
It's so horrifying. Again, although it was never confirmed, it seemed suspicious that in a time when nearly everyone was struggling to make ends meet, Grossman never seemed to be hard up for cash and frequently loaned money to his neighbors.
Again, this is literally the fucking plot of Sweeney Todd.
Yes.
No one has money. Every fucking shop has no fucking meat, except this one shop has lots of meat. They have lots of meat pies.
Crazy. Like,
where the fuck that's from? I don't know.
It's so crazy. I actually forgot that that was the plot of Sweeney Todd until you said it. And then I was like, oh my God, it totally is. It totally is the plot of Sweeney Todd.
They're like, how the fuck are we going to get rid of all these bodies? Oh, you have a fucking pie shop and you have no fucking meat because everyone's hard up for money.
Bake them in a pie.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Problem solved.
People pie.
Oh, no, no.
Girl.
I know. Apparently, this is not just the plot of a musical. It happened in real life, allegedly, but most likely.
That's awful.
Yes. I feel it's also worth mentioning that he also ran a hot dog stand at the train station near his home. So it was believed that some of the meat he sold there also contained the remains of his victims.
No one wants to know how the hot dog is made.
No.
But I want to know in this instance.
I would like a warning, please.
I would just, if that's what's happening, I need to know.
Yeah. It's one of those things, like, I could dismiss the butcher thing and be like, no, we got the beef. Everyone else ate the people. We got beef. But, like, if you bought a hot dog from him, you know. You know what the fuck was up.
Yeah.
It's horrifying. It's all horrifying. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Between 1919 and 1921, authorities found pieces of missing women in the water in the Lucenstock Canal and Engelbecken River. Sometimes on a daily basis.
Jesus.
What the fuck? Although they had been unable to put names to most of the victims and their identities remained a mystery, police began posting warnings throughout the neighborhood in August of 1921, stating that the butchered remains of several women had been washing up on the shores. And shortly afterwards, newspapers began reporting that the women had fallen victim to a sexual murderer, someone who gained sexual satisfaction from raping and murdering his victims, and thrived on the intimate violence of sexual assault. Although his next-door neighbors, Helena Itzig and her husband Mannheim, had previously turned a blind eye to Grossman's violent rendezvous with the women he brought home, and the awful smell coming from his apartment, once they saw the warnings posted in the neighborhood, they began to get a little suspicious that perhaps their neighbor was the man responsible for these murders.
Ding, ding, ding. Where the fuck have you been?
Yeah, literally right next door.
Literally right next door, and you heard it the whole time.
Yes. But they didn't know for sure and felt they needed proof, since it was their word against the man who was known as the Good Samaritan of the Silesian train district. So they decided to bore a hole in their neighbor's door so they could spy on him. It's unclear how much they actually saw of his crimes or how long they observed him before notifying the authorities. But regardless, before the month was up, they had alerted the police of their suspicions. On August 21st, 1921, Grossman found the woman who, although he didn't know it at the time, would be his final victim. Her name was Marie Nietzsche, and she had just been released from Moabit prison after a month-long sentence. When she told him this, he offered to buy her a celebratory drink, which she agreed to. After a few rounds at the local bar, he invited her back to his apartment for a cup of coffee. And once again, she agreed. Like he'd done to the many women that came before her, he drugged her coffee with cyanide, then raped her and beat her to death. As he prepared to butcher the body, however, the police knocked on the door. He asked them to come back later, but after hearing the panic in his voice, the police broke down the door instead. They found him covered in blood and standing over Marie's lifeless body. Having been caught red-handed and with nowhere to go, Grossman made no effort to escape and was promptly arrested.
Good. At least there's that.
Yes. Bloodstains in the apartment indicated at least three other people had been killed there recently, and investigators were convinced that he was responsible for the many dismembered corpses that had been found in the Berlin waterways. They spent several weeks interrogating him, trying to get him to confess, but he would only admit to murdering Marie and two other women. He insisted that the women had tried to steal money from him, and that he'd killed them in a rage afterwards. He told police that he had dismembered their bodies only to dispose of the corpses, and said it was a strategy other murderers in the crowded apartments of Berlin had used during the time he'd committed his crimes, implying that he wasn't responsible for all the body parts that washed up, or all of the missing women. He was just one of many murderers in Berlin disposing of the corpses of their victims in that way.
Oh, great. I feel so much better.
Right?
Assuming that's true, which it's not, that we're gonna, it's not like we're gonna let you go.
Yeah.
You're literally standing over a dead body, bro.
Yes. And you confessed to two other murders. Like, you're still going away.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Thanks. But police weren't convinced, and after interviewing his neighbors, some investigators began to suspect that Grossman had possibly murdered up to 100 women.
Can you imagine those fucking people, his neighbors, who may have heard 100 murders and were just like, could he keep it down? Like,
I would feel so bad. I would not be able to live with myself after that.
No, that's horrific.
It's awful. Also, how are you going to rent that apartment out after that? Like, come on. No one's going to want to live there.
Girl. Mm-mm.
After he was arrested and news of his crimes became public, many women came forward to give testimony regarding Grossman's sexual behavior and their experiences with him. Some of the women the police interviewed said that they had understood from the start that Grossman had expected sexual favors in return for his help, while others said that they had accepted his offer of becoming his housekeeper, believing it was legitimate, only to find out after the fact that it was all a ruse to get them into his apartment. For example, one unemployed industrial worker who was interviewed had accepted his offer of employment as a housekeeper in August 1921, the month he was arrested. And after she had worked for a day performing household tasks, he drugged and raped her. In the irony of all ironies, Grossman had apparently become rather notorious at the local police station over the past few years for accusing his female housekeepers of stealing money from him.
Shocking.
Which, like, bro, you're murdering people and they're not stealing money from you. Don't go to the police.
Also, maybe don't have the cops know who you are when you're engaging in murder on the reg.
Yes.
Tip for life. Or not. Get caught. Fuck you.
Correct. But yeah, apparently he was going so often that they just like got fed up with him and they were like, no, we're not taking another police report about your housekeeper stealing money from you. Like, go away. Although he did frequently target professional sex workers, more often than not, his victims were quote unquote respectful women. Those who were struggling to find work or mothers just trying to feed their children. And it seemed that the professional women, because of their experience, were actually far more likely to realize that there was something off about Grossman.
Mm-hmm.
A sex worker named Erica told the authorities that she found his residence and demeanor too creepy and ultimately decided not to go through with the transaction and, as a result, avoided the fate of his other victims. During the months-long investigation, the press, crime experts, and local citizens all tried to make sense of Grossman and his crimes. There was no doubt in the minds of investigators and medical experts that Grossman was a sexual murderer, a phenomenon that was well-documented and well-defined by this time, and was understood to be a pathological manifestation of psychosexual dysfunction. However, criminologist Robert Heindel also described him as an economic criminal, someone who murders for financial benefit, since it seems as though he was making bank selling parts of his victims to local butchers. Although it's rare for a murderer to be both, because it's kind of hard to profit off of murder, unless you're a hitman, I guess, Grossman did seem to fit the profile. His crimes became the stuff of legend, even before his trial began. The story was so unbelievably gruesome that it felt like something out of a crime novel, and the public had a morbid fascination with the Butcher of Berlin. His notoriety became so widespread that newspapers in other countries began reporting on the case, with a publication in Washington, D.C. writing about Grossman as if he was a comic book villain, describing him as, quote-unquote, beast in human form. But reports often varied on how he and his victims were depicted. Grossman himself was portrayed as either a cunning criminal clever enough to evade police or an imbecile with no control over his baser instincts, while his victims were either hapless innocents who suffered from need and hunger or, quote-unquote, depraved women, since some of his victims happened to be sex workers who were seen as less than at that time.
You know, there's been this meme that's been going around and multiple people have sent it to me, which thank you for that. And it's like every crime show is like, the serial killer is cunning. He's smart. He keeps evading us. And it's like every true crime podcast. It's like, despite a year worth of calls from neighbors to the police, yes, about a suspicious smell, the police did nothing. That's literally what the fuck it is. This guy wasn't cunning. Everyone knew what the fuck he was doing. It was just like, you know, not polite to rat out on the fucking murderer because he was like interrupting their tunes.
Yes. Also, apparently, like, because one, he had money from all of this fucking bullshit, he loaned money to a bunch of his neighbors. So, like, a lot of them weren't going to report him because they, like, owed him money. And, like, he helped them out. If they were in a pinch, they could call him and get money from him.
Yeah, but they all knew what the fuck. They all heard what was happening.
Yeah. Oh, you know.
Cunning. Give me a fucking break.
No, I know exactly what meme you're talking about, and it's too real.
It's so real. It is so real. I'm like, no, like, every fucking, like, that bullshit of like no one, you know, like they talk about like fucking Ted Bundy, like, oh my God, no one knew he was such a like good guy and whatever the fuck. His fucking ex-girlfriend and his college professor turned him in because they're like, that serial killer sounds a lot like my fucking student or my fucking ex-boyfriend.
Yes. This was a theme in American Nightmare too. This dude was reported so many fucking times. They knew who he was and he just like kept getting released and everything was just like brushed off and it was like, oh, it's fine. He's just a creeper, it's fine. Like, no. Infuriating.
Yep.
His trial began on July 2nd 1922, and unsurprisingly was the event of the year. Several of his surviving victims detailed their experiences at the hands of the Berlin Butcher. Despite consistent reports from the women regarding his actions, Grossman's defense counsel argued against their testimony.
What was their defense? Nuh-uh.
Basically, yeah. There was surprisingly little information about the trial. There were a couple testimonies from women, but it's like all the same. It's all the same stuff, like that he drugged and raped them and they woke up tied to the bed and like.
Yeah. And also, how are you going to defend that?
They literally caught you red-handed. Like, you were over the body with blood on you.
Literally.
Claiming that their stories were not only implausible, but untrue. When his neighbor, Helena, who had turned him in, testified, Grossman himself accused her of having known about the murders and trying to blackmail him. Her and her husband had admitted to owing him money and were known to have socialized with him in local bars and amusement parks. The prosecution presented to the court a list of 23 missing women who had been seen in the company of Grossman before they disappeared, and who authorities believe that he had killed and disposed of. Unfortunately, after just 3 days of testimony, however, the trial was cut short when Carl Grossman was found dead in his jail cell on July 5th, 1922.
Fuck you.
Yep. Having hung himself to escape the inevitable death sentence he was facing.
Piece of shit.
Yep. Took the easy way out.
Motherfucker.
I know.
Sheep fucker, actually. Sorry, my bad.
Literally. Yes, charged and sentenced. Correct. Yeah. Now, I read a couple of sources that said he was found guilty and actually sentenced to death, which he apparently laughed at before he died by suicide. But again, the most detailed and comprehensive source said his death occurred before the trial was completed, and I'm more inclined to believe that was actually the case. I kind of feel like some of these were, like, sensationalized.
Sure.
Although investigators only had enough evidence to prove at most 20 victims, they still believe that Carl Griswold had likely murdered.
Oh my God.
I know. It's infuriating.
I thought you were going to say like 3 or 4. 20? Jesus fuck.
Yes. There was a quote from a newspaper article published around the time that said they had conclusive evidence to prove 15 to 20.
Uh-huh.
Which is a lot. But again, they still believed that Carl Grossman had likely murdered up to 100 women. Unfortunately, since he died before he could give a full confession, the true extent of his crimes will forever remain a mystery. And that is the story of Carl Grossman, the Berlin Butcher.
That was horrific, Amy.
It was pretty horrific. I'm sorry.
Welcome back to the trauma.
I know. We gave you a couple of nice, funny, lighthearted stories.
Yes.
And now this is a goddamn horror podcast. So
that's fucking right. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. I hate everyone. I hate all of his neighbors because they heard all of his murders.
Yep. Even if it was just the assault and rape, like,
hate him.
Still really fucked up.
You don't have to insert yourself. Just call the cops and be like, yo, some wild shit's happening.
Yeah, I don't want to say my name, just so you know, this is going down. Here's the address.
And just because certain things were quote-unquote accepted at the time doesn't mean you had to accept them. Spoiler.
Correct.
Like, my great-grandmother in Cuba, my great-grandfather fucked around on her a lot. In 1940s Cuba, she was like, you know what? Fuck you. I'm divorcing your ass. Because even though it was acceptable for your husband, especially who was like well-to-do with money, to fuck around on you, my grandmother was like, you don't know who the fuck I am, motherfucker. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Fucking with the wrong Marie.
Yes. That might be okay for some people, but that is not okay for me.
Correct. So even if it was like fine in Germany to beat the fuck out of your wife or whoever, it isn't. Spoiler.
Seriously. It's ridiculous. The inadvertent cannibalism really gets me. That's the thing that, like, really.
Oh,
I know. I feel like I've become desensitized to murder and rape after this podcast. But, like, the fact that, like, a bunch of Berlin citizens might have eaten human flesh because a murderer was selling bodies to the butcher. Like, oh, that's going to haunt my dreams. That's going to haunt my dreams.
You're just like, girl, I just wanted a chili cheese dog, man. What the fuck?
Right.
You know, fuck.
Seriously. I'm going to stick to plants after this. Thanks.
Yeah, right?
I'll have a grilled cheese.
Oh, grilled cheese is so good, though. Fuck.
Yeah. No body parts. Great.
There you go. Love a grilled cheese. That was amazing. I'd never heard of that horrific story, shockingly. But you did an amazing job, as per usual.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I loved your story. I had not heard of that either. And just insane. I didn't think a paranormal story could get to the level that somebody died / was murdered by their grandfather's spirit. I'm not really sure what it qualifies as, but something happened.
For sure. What the fuck? In multiple reports. So, like, I literally don't know. It was weird.
Insane. But that was great. And I loved it. And I love you.
I love you. And we love you. This is another fucking horror podcast, guys. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Monique Sanchez.
And I'm Amy Traden.
You can find me on the gram at pinupgirlmo.
You can find me at lobotomy, and that's lobot period Amy.
Follow the show on the gram. We're at another fucking horror podcast. I've been a little bit under the weather the last couple weeks. So I took a little break from the gram, but I'm going to be back on that shit, posting shit. And we definitely have some exciting stuff coming in the next few weeks, so keep an eye out. Every sixth episode, we do a True Listener Tales episode where we read you your true crazy stories. So if you have one or you just want to say hi, email us at anotherfuckinghorrorpodcast@gmail.com with a period instead of the U in fucking. And if you like the show, tell a friend, tell multiple friends, but definitely rate, review, and subscribe, and leave us a review, because even if you leave a bad one, we'll read it.
Girl,
we're so obsessed with you. As always, keep it cute.
Keep it creepy.
Bye. Bye. Girl.
I was going to say the same thing. I love you. I was like, we should say girl instead of bye at the end. I was like, I love it so much.